program of the Newman Foundation. The Newman Foundation is a nonprofit organization that is dedicated to the Newman Apostolate. And if you ask me what all that involved, I wouldn't be able to tell you. But the short answer for our group is that we're focused particularly on university Catholics. Our talk tonight is Jesus on Trial, A Focus on Faith and the Death Penalty. We have a number of speakers coming up as well for our group, the Newman Foundation, as well as through the Chair of Catholic Studies, Dr. Hunter. On October 1st, Anthony Clark will be speaking on A Culture of Resistance, Catholic Women and Social Reform in Republican China. In April of next year, we will have, the Newman Foundation will have Dr. Gary Agee speak about Daniel Rudd, who is a Kentuckian born into slavery, converted to Catholicism, and was one of the founders of the National Black Catholic Congress, as well as being a very important figure in lay movements in the Catholic Church, as well as the founder and publisher of the American Catholic Tribune and the Ohio State Tribune. He also in April of 2016, as part of the series put on by the University of Kentucky on dangerous women throughout history, Gail Yee will be speaking on dangerous women of the Bible. For a Kentuckian, or for someone who's been in Kentucky a long time, the death penalty is not an impersonal abstract issue, nor is it something that you can make your own choice about and then just conform your own life to that choice and then you're sort of done with it. In Kentucky, because Kentucky still sentences people to death and still executes people and does so in the name of the state and all the people in the Commonwealth, there really is no way to opt out of that system. When people are put to death, they are put to death in our name. We can't take our name off of it. So this is an issue that is personal, but through that collective responsibility and collective action that is the death penalty. Maybe because of that, maybe because for all jurisdictions, which includes the United States government, in which the death penalty is still imposed and is still executed on individuals, the death penalty has been something about which the level of discussion among people and consideration among people has been very high, has been very thoughtful. People have opinions about the death penalty, about its rightness in toto, absolutely, or about in certain circumstances. People are called upon in Kentucky to serve on, or called in to serve on juries in which the prosecution may be asking for the death penalty. One thing that you might not know is that if you are inalterably opposed to the death penalty, then you will be excluded from that jury. That opinion, that kind of view in Kentucky is not permitted to serve on a capital punishment jury. Similarly, of course, if you feel that the death penalty is always to be administered, is always to be the sentence, for example, in a case of intentional murder, intentional homicide, then you also are excluded. But far more people are excluded because they are opposed to the death penalty than because they think it should always be administered in certain circumstances. Our speaker, Mark Osler, who is a professor at, I get this backwards sometimes, St. Thomas University, realized that people were having discussions about the death penalty at this very high level, and this very considered level, but surprisingly among Christians, they weren't necessarily linking that discussion or their consideration of the death penalty to their religion. And even more so, they weren't linking it to the most famous capital trial and the most famous execution in human history, that of Jesus. So he began to explore What is it about that? What can that trial, what can that execution tell us about our system today of sentencing people to die and of executing them? Out of that work came two things, which we'll discuss in greater detail. One of them is a book, Jesus on Death Row, which, if you all are stimulated to look into it further, is available for download from Amazon and from iTunes and those sorts of things. So, Professor Osler went to the College of William and Mary for his undergraduate. He graduated from Yale Law School in 1990, then clerked for a judge and worked at a private firm for a while. But in 1995, he realized a dream and an ambition of his and became an assistant U.S. attorney, that is the prosecutor, the federal prosecutors, in Detroit, Michigan, which is where he grew up. He was, his brief was basically to prosecute crack cocaine cases, hundreds of them, in which there was always a mandatory minimum to the sentence and often a great deal of rigidity in the way that the sentence was approached. And for most cases, the biggest decision often becomes what is the sentence, because a plea bargain determines, in a sense, what is going to be the guilt, the charge on which the person is guilty. He was not comfortable with that system. He had a conversion moment in that, or had heard something that led to the start of a conversion to that. In 2000, he began to teach, or he went off to teach at Baylor Law School, and in 2010 at St. Thomas University. He is has held a chair in preaching at an Episcopal church, and is a man who has worked a lot to incorporate his beliefs and his faith into his day-to-day life, but also to these important questions for our time. So please welcome Professor Mark Osler.
Thank you so much for that. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
I've got the wireless because I wander around a lot. In fact, the first time when I started teaching that I ever used a wireless, it was at a law review symposium at Valparaiso. And I was the second speaker. And the first speaker was this legendary constitutional scholar named Erwin Chemerinsky. And Professor Chemerinsky gave this blindingly brilliant lecture where he was going without notes and giving pin sites to, you know, the exact page in a case that he was citing to. And it was like he was coming up with a law review article on the fly. And then he's done. And he had written the book that all the students used in Conwa at that school. And so I'm the second person. And so I stand up and I'm a relatively new professor. And a student runs over with the wireless microphone, this thing. And I said, wow. And the first thing I did was play air guitar for a while and go, wow. And what I didn't realize was that they were going to print everything verbatim in the law review. And they had in there, you know, Chemerinsky and his flawless lecture, and then Osler plays air guitar. I'm not going to do that tonight. But thank you so much for that kind introduction. I'm going to start at the beginning and tell you how I got to care about this. The death penalty isn't something that I thought about much when I was growing up or when I was in law school. I'm from a state, Michigan, that hasn't had the death penalty for decades. I live now in Minnesota that hasn't had the death penalty since 1911. But I did grow up in Detroit. When I was a young child, we lived in the city on the east side, on Harvard Road. Anyone here from Detroit? Well, my first memory is when I was 4 years old. And that was 1967. There were terrible race riots in 1967. that killed and injured hundreds of people. 2,000 buildings were destroyed. And of course, in trying to get it under control, things became worse. First, the Army Reserves were brought in, the National Guard, and then the regular Army came in. The United States Army occupied the city of Detroit. And the armored personnel carriers came in to the city and finally regained control. It was deeply tragic. It was rooted in years of racist police practices. Those aren't things that started recently. They were rooted in economic disparities. They were rooted in a failure for different communities to talk to each other. But when you're four, you don't know any of that. And all I knew was that we had to stay in the house. My parents were very certain about that. And when you tell a four-year-old that you have to stay in the house, what a four-year-old's going to do is leave the house. And so the first chance I got, I made a run for it and ran down Harvard Road towards the intersection. And I got almost there and I looked up and there was a soldier and a vehicle. And if you imagine yourself at four, seeing that your city is occupied by the Army. And I turned around and ran back the other way. And all I remember is my mother coming up behind me and scooping me up in her arms. As I grew up, my family, like a lot of other families, black and white, left the city. We moved to the suburbs. But I always had it in my mind that I wanted to make things better in that city. Went away to college, came back after college. turns out, with a history degree in Detroit, there's not a lot of jobs for you. And I got a job as a flower delivery guy, and I needed a second job. And so I answered a tiny ad that said, young, resourceful person needed. That could be a lot of bad stuff. but it turned out it was a law firm that needed someone to be a process server, to go serve the summons and complaint to people who were being sued. And so that's how I got into law, was by serving summonses in Detroit. And I thought, I can do this. I can do law. So I'll go to law school. So I went to law school. And while I was in law school, I came to love criminal law, the morality that's embedded within it, that sense of right and wrong, the fact that it always makes a difference. There's always people that care about it, unlike a lot of civil cases. At least one person is going to be profoundly impacted by it, and usually more than one. So I decided that's what I wanted to do, and I wanted to go back to Detroit to do it. And I did believe in the project of prosecution, and I do now. If I was to go back into the full-time practice of law, I'd want to be a prosecutor again now. Now, what we were doing in our drug cases, as you mentioned, I had problems with. And that's a whole other lecture. But eventually, I decided that I wanted to go teach. And when you've been out of law school for 9 years, it turns out that the academy frowns on that much experience. I ended up getting a job in a place I never thought I'd live, which is Waco, Texas, where Baylor is. And I go down to Waco. And that's when I started to care about the death penalty. Because in Texas, they have the death penalty. And then it's something that people deeply believe in or don't, but they think about it and they talk about it and they read about it. And there was this one day that changed everything. And here's what happened. I got up and read the paper Sunday morning, and there was a story in the Waco Tribune Herald about an execution that happened that week down in Huntsville. And it described in the lead of that story what we often find in the lead of those stories, which is it described what the person's last meal was. What did they eat? And it was something incredibly understandable. You know, cheeseburger, a cupcake, Dr. Pepper. And that really struck me, you know, this food, that mattered. So then I went to church. And I was going to a Baptist church in Waco. And, you know, Baptists aren't great at the Eucharist so much. They only do it once a month. People drop the plate as it's being passed around. But it just happened that it's the Eucharist that Sunday. And I held the host in my hand and realized in that instant that this represented the last meal of a man who was condemned to be executed. And he knew that at the Last Supper, that this was the last meal. And there was something so compelling about that, that there's this connection. And I realized that if I wanted to talk about the death penalty in Texas, I'd have to do it in church. And that I had to find a way to bring together our discussion about this political issue with our faith. If it wasn't for Christian support, there wouldn't be a death penalty in the United States. The numbers just bear that out. Now, there are many Christians who oppose the death penalty. There's many non-Christians who oppose the death penalty. I started to talk to people about this in Waco. And I found many people had been involved in the death penalty apparatus in a direct way. There were something like 11 people in that one church in Waco, Texas, who had been on a death penalty jury. Two of them had been four persons. And so to engage in this, I came up with a project. And the project was, at one level, really stupid. And what I wanted to do was put on the trial of Jesus under Texas death penalty rules and use the congregation of this Baptist church in Waco as the jury. And I got one of my colleagues, Bill Underwood, who's now the president of Mercer down in Georgia, to be the defense attorney. I'd be the prosecutor. Now, the stupid part was, if you're an untenured faculty member at a Baptist school in Texas, probably prosecuting Jesus isn't a good move. But it turned out to be a really fascinating exercise. And when I go back to Waco, people still talk to me about that. And that led me to write the book. And then also to continue, after a period of some years, that project of doing the trial of Jesus with collaborators. I've done it in 11 states now. We focus on death penalty states, and we try to go to places where people support the death penalty. One of my theories of advocacy, I'm a professional advocate, is that it's useless to talk to people who already agree with you. And to kind of revive the trial, this came to me at a big death penalty conference in Atlanta. And I was one of the speakers, and I was all charged up because the book had just come out. And so I go down to Georgia, and I give my talk, and everybody applauds, and they think it's great. And then the next guy gets up, and we all applaud. Well, we were all against the death penalty in the first place. And I realized that to reach people who supported the death penalty or had made up their mind, we had to get to their church. And that doing that trial was a good way to do that. We've done it at Regent University, which is Pat Robertson's school, down in Virginia Beach. We've done it at Feller Seminary in Pasadena, which is the world's largest evangelical seminary. big church in Oklahoma City, twice in Texas. And so it's been a fascinating series of discussions. What I want to talk about tonight is, all right, what of faith in the death penalty? When we do the trial, if we were doing the trial here tonight, we wouldn't have an explicit discussion of, you know, why before or against the death penalty. Instead, we just do the sentencing phase. We break people into groups of 12 and they deliberate. We try to start that engagement of the faith aspects of their life with their thoughts about the death penalty. But tonight I want to speak more directly about it. How does faith engage with the death penalty.
Why does it matter?
And I'm going to talk about some of the things that I've written about more directly in a minute. But first, let me talk about, you know, what's embedded in the faith that talks about the death penalty. First, we have a rare thing with capital punishment in that the Bible, the Gospels, give us an example of Jesus being called over to an execution in John 8 and being asked to opine on it. Think how easy it would be to develop our ideas on other social issues if Jesus had been called over and asked, well, what do you think of this? But with the death penalty, we have that in John 8, where the woman is about to be executed, and the Pharisees call Jesus over. And you'll remember that he doesn't respond right away. He goes down and scratches something in the ground with a stick. And then he asks them, he's without sin, cast the first stone. And the oldest ones, the elders first, they walk away and they drop their stones. Now I've heard people say that, well, that's just saying that this isn't an appropriate punishment for adultery, which is what the woman was accused of. Well, it was in the Mosaic law. That was exactly the punishment that was to be accorded that person. And second, don't you think that Jesus might have been more direct in saying that, if that's what he meant, is that this doesn't fit that crime? He didn't turn towards her and address her crime. He turned towards those with the stones in their hands and said to them, you don't have the moral right to do this, even though it is in the law. It's one of the many things where Jesus challenges what had been before, had moved from laws and rules to principles. At the very least, John 8 has to challenge the way that we think about the death penalty. It has to mean something. And then the second thing, too, is that we have in Matthew 25 this remarkable passage where Jesus is talking about those who feed the hungry, feed me. Those who give water to the thirsty, give water to me. Those who visit those in prison, visit me. That's a profound challenge to the way we think of the world. That Jesus is the prisoner? And he doesn't say the political prisoner. He doesn't say the innocent prisoner. He talks about the least of these. And who is more least than those who are condemned? Though many of you have visited prisons, and you know how very real that is when you go into the prison. The dignity that's stripped away, the freedom, even your identity. I get letters every day from people who are in prison who want my clinic at my school to help them. And they're identified by a number. And if I don't put that number on the envelope, it won't get to them. It's not their name. It's not their personhood. It's this number that's been assigned to them because it hadn't been used before. And so we have that. And then the third thing is this. That at the center of the faith is an execution. That if you're like me, and you believe that the life of Jesus wasn't random and a chance, that God crafted that life to teach us things, to show us what was important, then those things that God chose are what we need to look at. It means something that God chose Jesus to be born into poverty. He wasn't born to a king. He wasn't born to riches. We all know the story. He was born in a stable. And every Christmas, for most of us, there's that reminder. There's that reminder that God came to us through poverty. And that has to tell us something about poverty. And Given that so much of what we know about Jesus, about the story of the Gospels, is about Jesus as a criminal defendant, as someone who was tried and executed and received process and suffered death in that way, doesn't that have to mean something? I mean, regardless of how you come out on the death penalty, don't we have to view it through our faith, given that if God crafted this life, he chose that life to include this period of judgment, of being held, of being arrested, of being tried, of having that case reviewed. So I want to go back a little bit to some of the things that happened in the course of that. We focus often on, because of the faith aspect, obviously, on the execution itself, and I'll get to that. But let's recall, too, that when I say that, you know, Jesus was a criminal defendant, that he was executed, that's unusual amongst religions, that, Muhammad died at 63. The Buddha died at 80 of natural causes or food poisoning, depending. And so it's not casting some common fable into the faith. It's something that's different and striking and fairly unique. So let's start by talking about the investigation. There's always an investigation, and there was an investigation of Jesus, too. Now, when I was a prosecutor, the part of the job that I really loved was doing investigations, working with good case agents, and figuring out what was going on. It was like solving mysteries over and over again. There were some great cases where we had to figure out what was going on. One of them was this. I'm sitting at my desk, and a guy has an appointment with me. I don't know who he is. He comes in. It turns out he's a mall cop. And I'm a federal prosecutor. We don't take cases from mall cops. Now, it turned out that he was the chief of the mall cops at a fancy mall north of the city, Somerset Mall. And he had the whole uniform on with the epaulets and the badges and, you know, medals for some reason. And so he came in and sat down, and I said, okay, you know, what's going on? And he said, well, people keep breaking into cars in the parking lot of our mall and stealing airbags and the radios and sometimes the tires, but mostly the airbags. I hadn't really heard about that. I said, huh, wow, that's kind of weird. Thank you, Mr. Mall Cop. And off he went, because I had told him, you know, we don't do theft. Theft isn't a federal crime. That's a state crime, so really can't help you. But it kind of worked on me, this story, in no small part because I had my own radio stolen 3 times out of my car. Once while I was in church and my car was parked in front of it, that particular time the guy also went through my tapes and took some of them, which I found insulting. I was going through them and like, yeah, the fat boys got it. I don't know. But and when that happened, I went to the police and asked the police, you know, said, I want to report that my car radio was stolen. And I remember the sergeant behind the desk was like, no, really? Yeah. And then I realized he was making fun of me. He said, you know, there's nothing we could do. Well, we're never going to find the guy who stole your car radio. You know, he's taking it somewhere. And so it was a little bit personal to me. And I realized that if we went after the fence, maybe we could catch this. We could do something about this. And so we investigated it. We started to follow people who we were caught stealing airbags. And it turned out they were all selling them in the same place on the east side of Detroit, a place called Beck's Wheels. And this guy, Beck Wooten, was doing the buying and selling. And one of the first things I did is I got a really good FBI agent named John Ryan came to help me. And he was this really geeky-looking guy with square glasses. He was a metallurgical engineer before he entered the FBI. And one of the first things we did was send him in to sell an airbag. And so, you know, he kind of goes in and says, hello, I have an airbag I'd like to sell. And the person behind the counter says, okay, well, we'll give you $60 for it. That's the price. And but you have to sign this form. And you know what the form said? The form said, "I certify that this airbag is not stolen." And at that point, I realized the challenge we were going to have in prosecuting this guy was going to be showing his state of mind. Because I had to prove that he knew the airbags were stolen. And so, you know, it wasn't a challenge to show that he was buying stolen airbags. We had plenty of proof of that. We set a camera up outside and just showed people stripping cars and bringing stuff in. It was showing that he knew it was stolen. And so one of the things that we did, because when you're dealing with a state of mind crime, what someone believes or thinks or knows is very difficult. You can't take the brain out of their head. The best way to prove that is to get them to say something, is to trick them, to trap them, to elicit a statement that where they admit that the stuff is stolen. We put a wiretap on his phone, and he was calling this guy in California, and they talked about how many steals they had. That was pretty good. But that's the kind of thing that we had to do very often in a case where state of mind was important. Now, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes, they tried to get an incriminating statement out of Jesus. And they tried over and over again to try to get him to say something that would reveal blasphemy, that would reveal a threat to the Roman rule, that would reveal a heresy so clear that the people would turn against him. And, you know, some of them we know very well. They put a coin before him and say, you know, should taxes be paid to Caesar? And if he said no, it would have been very easy to have the Romans take him down. But you remember what he says. Render unto Caesar what is his. After asking whose face is on that coin. And there's other times that he's quizzed. They ask him, a woman is married, her husband dies, and so she marries the brother. And this happens 7 times. In heaven, which husband will she be with? Now that's a pretty tricky question. And of course, Jesus responds by saying, in heaven, there is no male or female. In John 8, even, we see that there's that attempt to trick him by taking him to what was a lawful execution and then challenging him with it. Now, they fail. They fail to get him to make the kind of statement that would make it easy to either have the Romans execute him or have the people support the elders' attempts to have him killed. But eventually, they resolve to do so, especially after he overturns the money changers' tables in the temple. And so they're going to have him arrested. And, you know, one of the things as a prosecutor, once I started digging into this, it was fascinating because I was reading the Gospels anew. Suddenly I was reading it as a prosecutor, and all these things that we did, they were doing. You know, trying to get the statement to prove state of mind. They did that. And now they were going to arrest him. When I was a prosecutor, we always did strategic arrests. And arrest wasn't an easy thing. I mean, arrest is a dangerous thing. Because if you are going to go and arrest someone at home, you don't know who else is going to be in there. You don't know if they have guns. It's a really dangerous situation. And it's very carefully staged that you want to have quick and overwhelming force. You want to have more people than are going to be opposing you. You want to move fast so that you have the element of surprise. You want to choose a time to enter when they will be incapacitated by sleep. And so if we were doing executing an arrest warrant on a drug dealer, we do it at 6 o'clock in the morning. And we're very careful about that. It was kind of a pain for everybody to get up that early. And you would have 10 people. And you'd assign people to do the entry. Sometimes it would be a task force. People from different jurisdictions would gather to do that. There'd be federal agents, there'd be Detroit police, there'd be state police. When Jesus was arrested, they arrested him strategically. They waited until his supporters were asleep. And then they entered with quick and overwhelming force. They had Herod's men were there amongst the religious leaders' men as they entered. And of course, there was violence. The slave Malchus had his ear cut off by Peter. And so even using quick and overwhelming force, there was violence. But there was something else going on there, too, that was very familiar to me. And that was, how did they know where Jesus was? Well, they used an informant. They used a paid informant. And the use of paid informants is one of the more troubling aspects that we see in American criminal law now, the investigation. They're necessary in certain types of investigations, but they also make things much easier. And sometimes they're unreliable because they have a motivation. They're either getting a break on their own case or they're being paid. Some undercover informants do very well. Even when I was a prosecutor, which was a while ago now, we had at least one informant who made over $60,000 a year just by providing information. The informant they used was Judas. And again, once I started digging into this, it all started to make sense from what I knew as a prosecutor. Well, why Judas? Why would they go to Judas or approach Judas or listen to Judas? Because when we try to identify the person within an organization, within a conspiracy, to try to flip and give us information, we always try to find the person who'd been disrespected, the person who had a chip on their shoulder, felt that they weren't seen for their full value. And that was Judas. I mean, you'll remember the incident that happened before the, not long before the arrest, where Mary anoints Jesus with oil, and Judas reproaches her and says, "What are you doing? We could sell that oil, and we could give the money to the poor." And Jesus says, "Don't stop her. The poor boy is with you, but not me." Think if you're Judas. And here you are, you think you're doing the Christian message. You're saying, you know, don't waste this expensive oil on, you know, anointing him. You know, let's sell it and give it to the poor. And then in front of everybody, Jesus tells you you're wrong. It shouldn't surprise us that Judas was the one who flipped. And that he did it for money as well. Again, that's something that we see now. Let's jump ahead to the trial. The trial had a prosecutor, Caiaphas. And Caiaphas is a fascinating character. When we do the trial of Jesus, I get to be Caiaphas. So I've gotten to know him pretty well. Among other things, one of the fascinating parts of it is Malchus, the slave whose ear got cut off, he was Caiaphas' slave. And so he was pretty invested in this. But something happened in that trial. And we know from the gospel accounts that what happened was this, that the witnesses conflicted with one another, that they weren't telling the same story. And the prosecutor became frustrated. In fact, at the end of the trial, Caiaphas does something that seems almost like slapstick. But as a prosecutor, I can understand, he tears his shirt. He tears his shirt and says, "Why do we need more witnesses? Execute him." I can tell you where that frustration comes from. And I have a lot of sympathy for Caiaphas. And it's from this. Think about the job of a prosecutor. That the job of a prosecutor is to go into a room and to look at someone else in the eye and to say, "I want you to lose your freedom. I want you to be locked up for your child's high school graduation. Or I want you to die."
Think about the emotional commitment that gives a person. When your job is to look at someone and say, I want to take you away from society, or I want you to die. Of course they're committed. Of course they're sometimes overcommitted. It's in the structure of things. It's in the role of that person. And we see this with Caiaphas, that he calls in witnesses, and they come and testify, and they say different things. They conflict. And he becomes more frustrated as it goes on. You know, one thing that finally made sense to me as I understood it this way was this. That why did a servant girl come up to Peter, who was sitting outside, and say, do you know Jesus? Well, she's looking, it was Caiaphas' servant girl. She's looking for witnesses. What if Peter had testified? You know, it kind of changes things when we realize he said he denied knowing Jesus. What if he denied knowing Jesus because he didn't want to go in and testify? Because he would say, I mean, and Peter was a true believer. Yes, he is the Son of God. Yes, he did say these things. And so maybe by denying that he knew Jesus, what he was doing was avoiding being a witness. But let's go back to Caiaphas. You know, that ripping of the shirt, that emotion of the prosecutor is something that drives some of the wrongful executions that we see today. And the wrongful sentences that end up being, where people end up being exonerated, or there's a reversal of the sentence of death, a vacation of that sentence. I mean, here in Kentucky, there have been, I think, 70-some verdicts for death. There have been 50 reversals. So we're very often wrong about these things. And one of the reasons we're very often wrong is because prosecutors are committed to their task. And there's an objectivity that goes away at that moment. And that emotion escalates with the seriousness of the crime, particularly where there's victims involved, where they are coming to you and saying, you know, we have to have a conviction. We have to have a death sentence. That carries a lot of weight, the victim's family members, if they present that to the prosecutor. Kentucky hasn't deeply examined, as even the ABA committee has recommended, the procedures that are engaged in here. Illinois did. And Illinois had a series of exonerations that was brought about by a journalism project at Northwestern. And they decided they'd look more closely at the way the death penalty process worked there. And that brought on more exonerations. And eventually Governor Ryan emptying death row until they could come up with better procedures. And then they came up with better procedures, and then they had the same problem again as they were looking at it closely. And finally, Governor Quinn signed away the death penalty in Illinois. When he was there, when he did that, it was kind of a remarkable thing. He had a Bible. He had Sister Helen Prejean's book. And he talked about faith as one of the reasons that he wanted to get rid of the death penalty. Now, once Jesus was sent away to be executed, once Caiaphas convinces the council to vote for execution, what happens next also matches our own process. In a really striking way. You'll remember that right after they vote, the next step is that Pilate considers the case. And they go to Pilate. And it's interesting. Caiaphas comes along and argues to Pilate why this was a just thing and it needs to happen. And of course, there's a mob there too. And Pilate turns to Jesus. It says, what say you? To me, that sounds a lot like an appeal. That there's a review of the case that was presented. Now, Pilate
has his doubts about the justice of this. And you'll remember that his wife had a dream, too, about not executing Jesus. But what he does is he sends Jesus on to Herod. And this is fascinating to me. I didn't know any of this. I had to look it up. I found a great book by Raymond Brown called Death of the Messiah that explained most of this to me. Raymond Brown was a brilliant theologian at Union Seminary in New York. My favorite story about him is that Duke wanted to hire him away, and so they sent someone up and met with him and said, we'll double your salary, you know, we'll pay you twice as much as you're making here. And he said, no, I'm fine here. The guy went away, and the people at Duke said, no, you gotta hire this guy. You know, he's an incredible theologian. And so they go back to him, and Raymond Brown says, you don't know about me, do you? I'm a monk. I don't make any money. You can double my salary. It will be zero. But Raymond Brown really did a good job of playing these things out and what they could mean. And the next thing that happens is that Jesus is sent on to Herod. Now, Herod had a separate area of authority than Pilate. That there's some dispute about this. First of all, there's a lot of Herods floating around. This particular Herod was one that some think was the given authority by Rome over Galilee, which was a different geographic area than what Pilate had authority over. I've also read others who think there was a different kind of authority from Rome that overlapped with Pilate to some degree. But needless to say, he had a different kind of authority. And so Pilate kind of allows the execution to stand. And the next step is this Herod. And Herod, of course, is pretty dismissive of it. Puts the purple robe on him, mocks Jesus. But in our modern process, we have an equivalent process, which is habeas, the habeas petition, which is an ancient writ going back from before the Magna Carta, where a prisoner can seek to be freed, often from the state, but often from the federal government, too. So if someone in Kentucky is sentenced to death, they can appeal through the courts in Kentucky, appeal to the federal courts, but then they can also seek a writ of habeas corpus. And they can do that to the federal government as well. And so you have the federal government looking at the case and offering, as a separate sovereign, an opinion on it. The Herod of the modern day. Now, of course, what happens after that? Well, it goes back to Pilate. And Pilate, at this point, is pretty troubled by it. But it's the Passover festival. There's a festival tradition of clemency. I talk a lot about clemency, and a lot of my work is wrapped up in clemency right now. People forget how ancient clemency is. Back to that very tradition. So there's two prisoners, Barabbas and Jesus, and they choose Barabbas to free. But that last ditch, that last choice, that last chance at clemency is exactly what the last ditch opportunity for someone who's about to be executed is in the United States, too. I mean, Jesus got a lot of process. Now, it happened in a very short period of time, but there was a lot of process that you had a trial, you had witnesses testify, you had an appeal, you had the equivalent of habeas, and you had a consideration of clemency. And what happened? How did it turn out that he was executed in the end? Well, part of it was that through each step there was a mob. There was a mob following him, crying for execution. When I was teaching at Baylor and got interested in this, one of the things that was appalling to me was this, that when someone was being executed in Huntsville, there was a party outside. That people would gather and barbecue and celebrate the execution. that in Texas, you have elected officials every step of the way, from the start to the finish, choosing what would happen. That the courts, the Supreme Court even, is elected. And so the popularity of the death penalty is going to drive them to approve death penalties. The governor in Texas almost never allowed someone clemency. When we were doing the trial of Jesus, one of the most remarkable encounters that I've had was this. My collaborator in this project for the past 4 years has been a woman named Jean Bishop. And Jean Bishop is a public defender in Chicago. She's an opponent of the death penalty. She's spoken all over the world. She also came to this the hard way. Her sister, her brother-in-law, and their unborn child were murdered by a 16-year-old. And so we were speaking at Belmont University in Nashville. And when we were done, we were walking down the hallway, and I saw a plaque on a door, Alberto Gonzalez. And I'd forgotten that Alberto Gonzalez was teaching there. He had been the Attorney General of the United States when he was working on reforming the crack laws. His name was always on the opposing brief. And I thought, well, God, I'd meet Alberto Gonzalez, you know? I mean, he's here. And so we knocked on the door, and there he was, and we went in. He had no idea who we were. Turns out he didn't write those briefs himself. He said, well, why are you here? We said, well, we're talking about the death penalty. And he said, oh, you're against it, right? And we said, yeah. And he said the worst thing he could have said. He said, you know what? I get so sick of you people. You would not feel that way if it was your brother or your sister or your mom or your kid. And that was the wrong thing to say to Jean Bishop. And if she didn't handle it the way I would have, which would have been throwing it right back at her, she said, you know, I know a lot of victims' family members. I'm part of an organization. Many of them feel exactly that way, you know, that they're for the death penalty because they suffered death. But let me tell you about my family. And as she told this story, you could see Alberto Gonzalez. He'd said this to the wrong person. And suddenly things opened up. And we were just people sitting around the table talking about things. And one of the things that we asked about was this. There was a woman named Carla Faye Tucker who was executed in 1998 in Texas. And Carla Faye Tucker had converted to Christianity. I mean, she was guilty. She committed a terrible axe murder while on meth. There's no doubt about the crime itself. There's no question, innocence. But she had experienced an incredible rehabilitation while in prison. And before she was executed, the governor of Texas at that time was George W. Bush. And the Pope, in fact, inveighed against the execution of Carla Faye Tucker, as did many other leaders in this country and outside of the country. And Gonzalez said, yeah, I do remember that. It's kind of funny because we always met, the governor and I, because he was his counsel, before an execution to review it. And when hers came up, the governor turned to me and said, do you believe it? And I said, believe what? He said, do you believe that she's genuine in her conversion to Christianity? And Gonzalez says, I don't know. And so Bush says, I want you to go to Gatesville, where the women's prison is, and find out. Go talk to her. And so he drives to Gatesville. He goes into the prison and sits down with Carla Faye Tucker and talks to her for an hour or so. And then drives back to Austin. It's like an hour and 15 minutes away. He goes back and sees the governor. And the governor says, well, what do you think? And Gonzalez says, I think it's true. I think she really has converted. And that's where his story ended. And Gene and I were sitting there thinking, well, why did you execute her then? And he said, well, you know, it's we had a policy that we would only stop an execution if the person was innocent or there was some fundamental flaw in the process. But I could tell that there was doubt. And when we're talking about something as important as death, something as final as death, there should probably be doubt in all of us. That this is one of those debates where it doesn't affect a lot of people. But because the effect it has on them is so profound, it's us as a state saying we have chosen this other citizen to die, that our full being must come into contact with that decision. And that must include our faith. Questions? Any questions?
I actually was struck by the by statements that were made around the time of the Tsarnaya sentencing, because there were family members who were very much opposed to his being sentenced to death, and then there were family members who were very resolved that this was the only thing that would be sufficient. Mm-hmm. I guess in that case, obviously, you're not going to be able to respect the victim's family's wishes entirely. That's the first question, weighing that. But then also, what really should be the role then of the, if you will, the victim's perspective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the question is, you know, what should the role of the victim's family members be? And that's a very difficult question. I mean, one of the things now that, since I've been working on this with Jean, I've gotten to know her family and the people she knows. And there's a couple of things. One is that they want to be respected, I think. And too often, one thing you have to remember is that as a prosecutor, if I have a case and I have a victim or a victim's family member, to me, that person primarily is a witness. They're going to help me to get to what I need in the trial. And if I need to convict someone and I have a victim, I need that person to do an eyewitness identification. I need that person to talk about how scary it was. If it's at sentencing and it's a victim's family member, you need them to talk about the impact it's had on their lives. And unfortunately, that means that it's an awkward relationship between the prosecutor and the victim's family member. And often it comes very soon after the crime itself. You know, the appeal is going for a long time, but that initial judgment and sentencing come pretty quickly. Well, they still haven't figured out how they feel. Sometimes the prosecutor is pressing them to testify, and sometimes how to testify. And I found victims' family members sometimes feel that they're being used by prosecutors. Now, I don't think that's a predominant view. I think prosecutors, I'm pro-prosecutor, I think they tend not to abuse that. But the process does demand that they view those people often as witnesses, and often for sentencing and asking for death, if that's what you're directed to do. But it's intriguing the way different states handle it. In Texas, for example, the victims have a right to testify at sentencing, but they don't get to testify until after the decision on punishment has been made. It's not recorded. And they're not allowed to directly address or ask. They're not allowed to directly ask questions of the defendant, and so they're allowed to be heard, but not necessarily allowed to have an impact on the outcome. Now, of course, they can still be called as witnesses by either side, and that's that. When I first heard about it, I thought that doesn't make any sense. But from the victim's family member's perspective, it does make some sense that statement is going to be theirs and theirs alone. One thing, too, that has been intriguing to me as I've gotten to know victims' family members is they very rarely talk about closure, and they often resent the idea of closure. Because, let's face it, if your sister has been murdered, you don't want to close off that.
it's not done. It's never going to be done. That for Jean and her family, this unborn child would be in college now. And they think about that. It's not closed. It's a wound that never does close and probably never can. So, other questions? Yes?
I was thinking about Jesus' trial and how his trial is both a religious one but also a political one, that he's executed for treason. I suspect a lot of the Christians who do support the death penalty talk about how there is how Jesus doesn't really get involved in the state and basically trying to stop the hand of Pilate or even that the thieves, they probably weren't thieves, they might have been zealots, and that he had zealots as disciples. So how would you address, I guess, how would you respond to people who would say that Jesus is mostly speaking to religious leaders and within, you know, when it comes to like, the Mosaic law, that the state is separate and the state does what the state does, and somehow answers to God in a different sort of way?
Yeah, I mean, The religious leaders very much were trying to make it treason against Rome. That Rome eventually had to conduct the execution. You know, that the cross is a Roman torture device, an execution device. The centurion is there to carry out the execution. And so I think a lot of the treason aspect of it, as opposed to the blasphemy part, is coming from that. But there's not a lot to support that in the gospel. I mean, of the what we know of the trial. I mean, we know that the witnesses conflicted, but we don't know that much about what they were talking about, other than the tearing down of the temple. You know, and they go again and again to Jesus saying, you know, in 3 days I can tear down the temple. Now that wouldn't be a threat to Rome. If a religious group tears down their own temple, it probably is not a big deal to the Romans. So in terms of that political side of it, it's hard for me as I'm digging into the Gospels to get my fingers into it very much, if that makes sense. The blasphemy part seems much more apparent.
I guess my question was, Jesus doesn't take sides with the zealots. He doesn't try to interfere to stop the kind of brutality that the state committed against their own people.
Yeah.
What's your take on this lack of response or this... because I guess we're talking about state and state executions, right?
Right.
I guess I'm trying to understand how you view Jesus' relationship with the state.
Well, he was a victim of the state. You know, I mean, that there was an unjust execution and it was carried out by the state. I think that, you know, the nature of the Romans was in an area like what Pilate and Herod had authority over, was to allow a certain amount of local self-rule. And probably the religious debates that Jesus was a part of didn't interest them. I don't think there was an engagement there or a feeling of being threatened. And certainly Jesus did not talk much about the Romans. Now, once we get into Acts and the epistles and the later books in the New Testament, we have much more about Roman rule. It's hard for me to come to a conclusion because I don't think there was that level of engagement. Yes?
I found what you said about the state of Illinois, how they eventually abolished the death penalty, very interesting. I wasn't aware of that. And what I found interesting was that it was seemed to be based on a thread of that the process was flawed, that the more they examined it, the process was flawed.
Right, it was innocence.
But one of your key points when you started out was that we don't have the moral authority to do this in the first place. And so my question is, because when I saw the movie Dead Man Walking, I was sort of horrified because at the end he was not recalcitrant and he was not sorry for what he did. But Sister Regina was still trying to say this is wrong. And so my question to you is, do you think in order to abolish the death penalty, kind of like separation of church and state, it has to be on the grounds that the process is flawed, when truly we would like to say it's because we don't have the moral authority to do it. And is that the conflict of the Christian, and that we have to play within the rules of the state, but our true belief is that it's just wrong?
It's both. I mean, I think that it depends on who we're trying to convince. I mean, I don't think, I think both. That innocence is a huge problem. The moral implications of the state killing innocent citizens, which almost certainly we have done through the death penalty, is terrible. It doesn't make the enterprise worth it. In terms of the moral authority as Christians to support this process, I think that's a valid argument to make in our society as well. That as individual voters, as individual actors, of course we're informed by our religious beliefs that we are going to support or oppose things based on that. And that does come into play. People's separation of church and state does not mean that individuals have to segregate themselves, unless, of course, they're acting as the state. Apparently an act of controversy here in Kentucky. If you're acting as the state, if as a prosecutor, I had made an argument to a jury saying, the Christian faith compels you to condemn this person, obviously I'm out of bounds. But as a voter, if I'm for or against the death penalty, that being informed by faith is certainly fair. And I think that's why it's important to talk about the death penalty in this way, in public, to talk about it to people who likely are Christian, who may be for, maybe against it. And it's even the simplest twists on things. I mean, when they talk to death penalty jurors who have found for execution, very often what they talked about was the Bible. And it's surprising how many times one of the things that jurors ask for is a Bible in the jury room. And their justification very often is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. And I wish I could talk to those people. because Jesus addressed that. That isn't what we're taught. I want to make sure I get this right. But yeah. In Matthew 5:18, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. If anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. I mean, that turn the other cheek is immediately after rejecting eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Now, that's pretty challenging. Doesn't that, at some level, undermine prosecution altogether? Do not resist an evildoer?
Yes.
Maybe it does. But at the very least, it problematizes the idea that eye for an eye is a Christian belief. Question. Yes, ma'am.
You said something about the prosecutor's job is to, am I right? I got the impression your job is to convict.
No. My job is to
get at the truth.
To get at the truth, but I'm going, once I decide that I think it's true, my commitment to that, let's say I have an investigation going on, and I'm working with a police officer. The police officer brings me evidence, and it's not sufficient. One of the reasons I loved being a prosecutor, and I would want to be a prosecutor again, is I can create justice right then. I can say, you know what, this isn't enough. I'm not taking this case. You can decline it. I mean, if you're a defense attorney, you have to pound your head against the wall all the way through trial. But if you're the prosecutor, you just turn the police officer back. And there's some jurisdictions where 50% of cases presented are rejected by prosecutors. So what I'm saying is once you take the case,
then you believe in it.
Right, and then emotional commitment only builds as you talk to the victims, as you look at the person.
Does it ever happen in the midst of that you start having doubts and wanting to back off?
Yes.
Yes. What do you do then? Yeah, I ask.
Then you have to be humble.
You know, I mean, Micah 6:8, justice, mercy, humility. Humility goes a long way towards both justice and mercy. And you're going to have a furious agent. You know, if you've got an investigator who's worked on this case for a year, and you're saying, you know what? I've decided now that we're on the verge of trial that we're not going to do that. All your work over the past several months is for naught. That's taking a professional risk. Because those people aren't going to bring these cases anymore if I'm going to bail out at the last minute. I'm going to have to be humble in doing that and take that hit and realize that there's going to be approbation professionally that I'll receive for making that decision. But that doesn't make, that still makes it right.
But if it's in the middle of a trial and somebody starts waffling, you have the power to kind of...
You have the power after the trial to dismiss the charges.
Really?
That's the way that some of these innocence cases have been resolved. Depending on the jurisdiction, but
in your discussion about being a prosecutor and listening to the families of victims, and I got the sense that you gave a lot of credence to those victims' families. Is that correct?
Yes.
That often they kind of help drive the whole process. Well, is that not just like the Pharisees in Jesus' story? Were they not the victims who drove the whole process?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I mean, that's the epiphany that I had over and over, is that what creates what's wrong with the death penalty were things that were very familiar to me. That... We all want to be liked by people who seem to have the moral high ground.
And then I guess that brings me back to the question then as a prosecutor in capital cases, then maybe you have even a greater moral responsibility to resist trying to listen to the victims and their families, because that weighs emotionally so much more heavily on the side of just trying to get, quote, justice for them as opposed to getting to real justice and truth.
It does.
In the situation.
And there's some deeply troubling cases that involve exactly that dynamic. There's one that I write about in my book where it was a rape case, and this man was incarcerated. There was two brothers, actually, who were incarcerated for life. And then they did DNA tests. It turned out that the DNA didn't match. And so the next theory that was that, well, maybe the DNA was from her husband, the victim's husband, and that, you know, the rapist, these brothers, had used condoms or something. And so there was sperm, it tested it, but it must be the husband's. Well, it turned, so they did a match, it wasn't the husband's. Then the victim said, it's another boyfriend's. And even then the prosecutors didn't give up. They kept those people in prison. That emotional commitment, when you have a victim that's counting on you to get to an outcome, it's so hard to give up on. And that is how we get to some of these wrong outcomes. Prosecutors are human, and we imbue them with these powers that are terrifying. To kill in Kentucky, in Texas, someone has to do it, but we have to pay a lot of attention to that. And we have to admit that it's fallible, you know? That it's a system constructed of people. It's not magically perfect, and it never will be. And that's a deep reality that needs to matter. Other questions? Yes, ma'am?
So many times it seems to me that people who are found guilty and given the death penalty are people who are not truly within themselves responsible at the time. Either they're on drugs, they're mentally incompetent, they're young.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like that's the group that seems to get hit more than anybody.
And also they're poor, the ones who actually get the death penalty. Yes, I mean, I agree with that. And one of the things that's this part of the discussion is that you often will hear that the death penalty is necessary to deter people from committing crimes. And here's the thing about deterrence, is deterrence works if two things are true. One, if the measure is communicated to the people who may commit that crime, and two, that person is conducting a rational cost-benefit analysis. That in the moment they choose to commit the crime, they're weighing the possible outcome, execution, against what's happening in that moment. And when you have people who are mentally incompetent, who are on drugs, who are in the spur of the moment, who are 17 years old, they're not doing a rational cost-benefit analysis. I mean, here's how screwed up we are in thinking about deterrence. Is that, okay, just keep in mind those two things, that if you want to deter, first, you have to communicate it to the relevant parties, and second, they have to do a cost-benefit analysis. Let me tell you about one instance in which that worked, and I thought this was brilliant. Rudy Giuliani was the U.S. attorney in New York, and there was a lot of insider trading. And so what he did to deter people who worked in big firms from doing insider trading was this, is that when they found someone and they indicted him for insider trading, they wouldn't go and arrest him at 6 o'clock in the morning at home. Some of you may remember this. They would go to that person's place of work, and they would have all these marshals with the police vests on and a news crew. And they'd go past the secretaries, and they'd go past the analysts, and they'd go to the corner office, and they'd cuff the person, and they made them do the perp walk back past all the people who worked for him. That creates deterrence. Because the other people who might be tempted to do insider trading, they see that, and they're business people. They are trained in doing cost-benefit analysis. If we really believed in deterrence in this country, we would have the harsh deterrence tools like mandatory minimums and the death penalty for financial crimes. Because those are the people that we can affect by deterrence measures. Not the 17-year-old on crack. Not the people that we see who receive those measures. Partial answer. Yes?
Seems like one dimension of the death penalty, that at least in the U.S., if you haven't mentioned, is the racial disparities. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that that's one of the strongest non-religious arguments to be made against the death penalty in terms of how it's unfairly imposed on African Americans.
I agree, but for the fact that that's not also a religious argument. I think that our faith compels us that people should be treated equally as well. But yeah, you're right. In terms of a secular argument, the racial part of it is important. I mean, one of the things, the history of the death penalty in this country is a history of racial unfairness. That in 1972, the Furman case struck down the death penalty in the United States. And it did so largely on racial grounds. Now, after that, that idea hasn't gotten traction in the courts in terms of it being a discernible way to avoid the death penalty. And there have been some experiments. North Carolina had a special rule, briefly, that dealt with race and the death penalty. But where we see disparities have as much to do with the race of the victim as of the perpetrator. So that if the victim is white, the person's much more likely to get the death penalty than if the victim is black. And so the way we tend to, as jurors, as prosecutors, as judges, to value white lives more than black lives is writ large in that truth. Other questions? Well, let me ask you, yes.
I don't have a question, but I just want to say I visited the guys on death row in Kentucky not too terribly long ago, a couple of months ago, and what you said is so true. Several of them said, one night on the street doing something goofy, and here we are. You know, I mean, so there was no thought of the consequences. And I'm not sure we teach people the consequences of their actions. And I think that's an area where we all need to work with our young people especially.
Absolutely. And we fail within our own family sometimes. I know I do. Raising boys to do that consistently. So, ma'am, I admire your work, that you do what Christ commands and you visit those in prison. For those of you that are advocates on this issue, I'm going to end with this, I guess. I think on something like the death penalty, a lot of times we feel like we're talking and nobody's listening. You'll remember at the start of all this, I talked about how I decided to not be a prosecutor anymore. What happened was this. I believed in mandatory minimums for crack. I was in law school. I had a sentencing professor who was against them. I was the kid in the class who was like, no, if we want it to be racially fair, we have to have the same standards for everybody. If we care about the effect of crack on black communities, we have to take, you know, tough measures to take it down while this epidemic is in its early stages. I went into court. I prosecuted cases with mandatory minimums. There was one case, an 18-year-old that I remember. This wasn't atypical. This was the typical case, really. He had 5.3 grams of crack and a gun under a couch cushion. And the mandatory sentence was 5 years for the crack and 5 years on top of that for the gun for a first offense. He was going to be in prison. There's no parole in the federal system. He was going to be in prison pretty much until he was 28 years old for that one first offense for that small amount of crack. In those cases, there was a defense attorney in Detroit who I often faced in these cases named Andrew Densimo. And he always gave what we prosecutors dismissingly called the futile speech, where the judge would say at sentencing, Mr. Osler, what do you want? And I'd say, Your Honor, it's a mandatory minimum of 10 years. I didn't even have to bring the file, you know? I don't want more than the mandatory minimum. Just give this kid the 10 years. And then she turned to Densimo and say, are you going to give your usual futile speech? And he went. And he'd go on for 20 minutes. And he talked about how locking this person up wasn't going to make a difference, that it was making the problem worse rather than better, that economically you weren't shutting down the business by sweeping up the low-wage labor. He talked about the effect on his community, the black community in Detroit. And eventually, even though I couldn't change any of those sentences, they were mandatory, I realized he was right. And I left. And I went down to Texas and I started teaching, I started working on crack. I started out working with the ACLU on a case in a town south of Waco where a DA every year did what he admitted to calling in his deposition the nigger sweep, where they would go into the one housing project they had and just round people up, often on false evidence. There's a movie they made about that case called American Violet, which is really good. Will Patton and Elfrid Woodard are in it. And then after that, I started working on at the federal level. And eventually won a case in the Supreme Court, United States versus Spears, where the Supreme Court said that there was a mechanism in the sentencing guidelines that someone would be sentenced the same for 1 gram of crack as 100 grams of powder cocaine. The Supreme Court in 2009 held that judges could categorically reject that ratio in the guidelines. And judges loved this because it gave them discretion back. And one of the judges that I knew from Detroit called me up, a guy named Bert Tarnow. And he said, hey, I saw the Spears case, Osler. Well, you know, and I hadn't seen or heard from him since I'd left the office 9 years before. And he said, what happened to you? You were a real hard ass when you were here. That's a direct quote. And I told him the story. I told him, well, you know, I heard Densimo's futile speech all those times. Realized it was right. And the judge asked me a really good question. He said, did you ever tell Andrew that? I never had. So I called him up. And I said, you know, do you see the decision? And he said, yeah. And I said, oh, you know, your futile speech. That's what started me down this road.
So make futile speeches, you know? Then think about that. The judge couldn't do anything. No one else could do anything. But it turned out it was the prosecutor he affected. And so if there's a truth, if there's an important truth that you want to advocate about, don't worry about futile speeches. They can be more powerful than you ever know. Thank you.
You didn't need it.